Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Diagnosing a Killer. I'm Coel.
And I'm Kenna.
How's it going?
It's going. It's been a good week, actually. Mm-hmm. I've been changing a couple things about my lifestyle, and I actually feel a lot better.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
I'm glad.
Cutting out on some of the bad things that I was doing. Bad things, but you know.
That anxiety is a little better.
Oh, yeah. I actually haven't had any in the last probably 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
Which is, like, incredible.
Right.
The little things you change, and then everything fixes itself.
That's great.
What about you?
I've been okay. I had 2 days off of work in a row, which is nice. Thanks to my coworker, because she's lovely. And, I'm excited to get back to work. I feel like the first day was just kind of, I wouldn't say lazy. I think I was just really taking my time doing things yesterday. So I didn't really feel like I accomplished a lot, which is like poison for people like you and me.
Yeah.
So today I decided to get up a little earlier and maybe not drive all around the city and just quickly get some lunch and then set up my computer.
Yeah, we had our sister telepathy thing today where I came home. I had gone to Sprouts and then I went to HEB, which is our local grocery store. And then I came home and on the counter there was a Sprouts receipt and then an HEB receipt. I was like, did you go to Sprouts and then HEB? You were like, yes. I was like, I've never been to Sprouts ever until today.
Yeah.
And that's so funny. I happened to go to both.
It's all right. They do, like, they have this vegan queso by Chow that's really good. And I don't eat cheese. So I really miss queso sometimes, and it's all, it's that and soy. I can't do soy either, so a lot of vegan stuff is soy, like no tofu. Oh my gosh. And then, so yeah, it's coconut oil, so I can eat a little bit of it.
Yeah. I went because they are the only place in town that has Irish soda bread, and that is the only bread that's not made with yeast, and I can't eat yeast, so I'm gonna try it out, but it's only made with raisins, and it has, like, sugar crystals all over it, so it's, like, a sweet bread. But maybe I can make, like, a PB&J out of it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That'd be yummy.
That's peanut butter and jelly for anyone not in America. I forget that's an American thing.
That is an American thing. I've seen those, like, UK tries or British tries, you know, food. But yeah, apparently peanut butter and jelly isn't a thing.
Nope, not a thing. Well, I'm going to try it out with that bread and I'll let you know how it is. Stay tuned.
Everybody has to try peanut butter and honey. Texas honey is so good.
I don't like honey, but
no?
I can understand the like of that.
I usually don't use honey. Maybe in some tea every once in a while when I have tea, but
you know that honey is the only food that does not perish ever?
No, I didn't know that.
Yep.
It's not vegan.
The more you know.
It's not vegan because it's made with bee spit.
With bees. It's made with bees.
Just mashed up bees. Yeah. Aww.
I'm looking forward to hearing your case.
Sure. Would you like to give everyone our handles?
Sure. Absolutely. You can follow us anywhere at Diagnosing a Killer besides Twitter or X, which is at Killer Diagnosis. We do have an email set up. Go ahead and send us an email if you have a case suggestion or you just want to say hi. That is diagnosingakiller@gmail.com. We also have a Venmo, PayPal, and Cash App if you'd like to support us monetarily. On top of that, we have a Patreon. That is patreon.com/diagnosingakiller. There are 4 tiers in that Patreon. Members in Tier 1 will get ad-free mental breakdowns every week. Members in Tiers 2, 3, and 4 will get ad-free every episode that we post. And members in Tiers 3 and 4 will get an additional bonus episode at the end of each month. That is a particularly gruesome case. No content warning, no really editing, we just kind of bring it to you, no banter or anything like that. So if you'd like to join our Patreon members in Tiers 3 and 4, I think there's about 12 of those bonus episodes out now, and they're getting another one in the next couple of days after this episode.
Yes.
All right, that's it.
You ready?
Yes.
Today we're going to be talking about Rodney Alcala, aka the Dating Game Killer.
Ah, yes. Not yes. Every time I say that, I feel bad immediately.
Oh, yeah. Murder. God.
Yes, I have heard of this, and I'm interested to hear the full story, because I know that there's some, like, speculations here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Just a reminder to our listeners that we are essentially reserving our content warnings for the end of our episodes for each other, so that we are uber surprised while we're listening to the story. So you're going to hear your content warning right now. Content warning, this episode contains topics of physical assault, sexual assault, and the murder of women and children. If this episode is not for you, we encourage you to find another one of our episodes. Remember that your mental health comes first, and we love you.
Love you.
Love you.
Bye. Bye. I love that you do that now.
Yeah.
We should keep that. Because like, last time we did a case that happened to you, you were like, right about now. And it was like, content warning.
And so we just plug, we record the content warning after the episode. So yeah, because everything's already been revealed. But then we take that and then we plug it into that little now.
It's fun because I'm not expecting anything at this point, you know, like expecting anything.
Right.
And if you say something specific in the content warning, it's like, okay, when's that going to happen? When's that going to happen? Exactly. And then, or if I'm like, oh, someone's going to get, this is going to happen. Oh, well, she didn't say it in the content warning. So, you know, it's kind of easier to decipher. So it's been working out.
Rodrigo, I guess it's Yaquez. Alcala Bucar was born August 23rd, 1943 in San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, shit.
To parents Raul Alcala Bucar, I guess it's Bucar. Bacua? I don't know if it's French. It's probably not. And Anna Maria Gutierrez.
Oh, we know Gutierrez.
We do. Rodney was one of four kids, all of whom were born here in the United States. Raul was the eldest, which is R-A-O-U.
Raul?
Raul. It's like Raul without the L.
Yeah, I thought you said Raul incorrectly, but I wasn't going to say anything.
Right. I guess it's an homage to the dad. Then there was Christine, Rodney, and then little Marie, which is an homage to the mom. When Rodney was just 5 years old, he began to attend St. Joseph's Catholic School, which was an all-boys school here in town. But it was actually, it's shut down since 2006. I Googled it because I was like, I want to go see. Rodney had only spent a year here before he would begin to attend Mount Sacred Heart, which was originally a military boys boarding school. So it is still around today.
It sounded familiar.
Mm-hmm. What was it? Mount Sacred Heart. Rodney would attend school in the States before his family received news that his grandmother in Mexico had become very ill. The family quickly dropped everything, and what was initially a visit to Mexico actually turned into the family moving to Mexico permanently. While Rodney was living in Mexico, he would attend his first co-ed school. Eventually, Rodney's grandmother would pass away, and within 3 years of the family living in Mexico, Rodney's father, Raul, would actually leave the family in Mexico while he moved back to the United States, and Rodney would actually never see his father after this.
Oh my God, do you know why he left?
I don't.
It could be one of, I mean, I'm thinking one of two things, like he left to find a better life and maybe bring his family over one day, or he left because he was like, fuck this, like, I'm out, I'm
or an affair.
Going to the States.
Yeah,
maybe. Yeah, something.
Found interest in someone else, who knows? Anna Maria would be alone with the four children, and in a pursuit for a better life, would move Rodney and his siblings up to California. The family was residing in Los Angeles by the time that Rodney was 12, and he and his siblings were once again put into another school, this time at St. Alphonsus Catholic School.
And how old is he at this point?
He's 12.
God, that's gotta be hard changing that schools that many times that young.
He's been to at least three or four that we know of so far. Rodney would finish out his middle school years at this school, but by the time that Rodney would then be age of entering high school, he would then be forced to attend yet another private Catholic school. So a lot of, like, non-permanency happening here. Regardless of all the family bouncing around, Rodney would maintain his grades, being called an exceptional student and joining the track and cross-country team, which is just jogging, y'all, if y'all don't have cross-country. I don't even know the origin of that. What do you run cross-country? What do you, Forrest Gump?
It's just jogging.
It's just jogging.
For a long time.
For a long time. Beginning to find himself, Rodney decided that he no longer wanted the label of graduating from a religious school, and he began to attend public school shortly before his graduation.
Wow.
He would graduate from Montebello High School in 1960. After graduation, Rodney set his sights on the military. He enlisted in the Army and opted to become a desk clerk rather than pursue any type of combat position. Rodney accepted a position in North Carolina at Fort Bragg, over 3,000 miles away from his mother's home in California.
Yeah, that's like literally across the country.
Like the opposite.
Directly across the country.
That might be on purpose. However, right away, Rodney's superiors noticed that his holier-than-thou attitude was kind of... It was very noticeable. He was often described as condescending, manipulative, insubordinate, and even vindictive.
Ooh, which that's not a good word to be described as.
You just got here. Can you chill out? Rodney was also noticed displaying misogynistic behaviors, often belittling female soldiers on base for not being on par with their male counterparts.
Cute.
He was even accused of assaulting a few women during his time in the Army. By the time Rodney was 20, his father had passed away. Rodney would be granted furlough to attend his father's funeral in California, which was noted as being exceptionally difficult for Rodney at the time.
That makes me think that Dad, like, maybe was with another person when he left or something. Like, clearly Dad wasn't a good role model, right, for Rodney. And so he comes up with this mindset of, like, I don't have to treat women good. My dad didn't. Why should I, you know?
And although I didn't see any reports of any physical abuse in the family, maybe, who knows, that's something, given what happens later,
right?
I would say that it's something that he was probably exposed to at a young age.
And you just never know. Like, a lot of these cases, we do see people talk about it because it's important to the story, but some cases like this, especially him moving out of the country, there might have just been... not a lot of, you know, information that was passed on, you know, from his childhood. So you just never know.
Anna Maria, the wife, the mother, might not have said anything if there was physical abuse inside the house.
Right.
If he's the breadwinner, the provider, and he's the one that's choosing to move the entire family to Mexico, he's clearly the head of the household. Rodney would return to work, but his attitude only worsened after the death of his father. In 1964, Anna Marie, Rodney's mother, would receive an unexpected knock at her door. Rodney was on the doorstep. When Rodney's mother asked why he was in town so unexpectedly, Rodney admitted to his mother that he had had a mental breakdown on base, walked off base, and then hitchhiked the 3,000 miles to her home in California.
There's no fucking way. He's like 3 weeks ago. Because like it would take forever to get there.
Ever to get there.
I don't care who you are. Voice cracks are always funny.
Always funny. Okay. I agree with you. I don't know when the mental breakdown happened. I don't know how long or how real his story is. But the fact of the matter is that Rodney at this point was declared officially AWOL or absent without leave. Okay. So he did not have permission to leave his duties at all.
Wow.
Rodney would eventually contact his superiors, who then encouraged him to come back without penalty, as long as he would be evaluated by military psychiatrists. They're doing their job.
Yeah, absolutely.
After Rodney was evaluated, he was then diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, chronic severe type.
Wow.
What's your opinion on that?
I mean, I don't mean this in a bad way at all, but that's an aggressive diagnosis considering, like, we don't really know much about his childhood.
Right.
So that makes me think, like, it's a lot of nature there.
Yeah.
Something's going on with my voice. I'm like,
yeah, totally.
But I don't know. I mean, these people are professionals, right? They obviously know what they see, and it makes a little bit of sense with his, like, arrogant attitude, I guess. But that kind of comes off narcissistic to me, not necessarily antisocial.
Well, I wonder the whole, like, AWOL thing, like, oh, I'm just going to leave this now. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to go this way.
Like, I don't care about that.
Like, I don't give a fuck.
Like, super apathetic.
Yeah. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, like, super apathetic. Like, I don't care about anybody. I don't care how my actions affect anybody. Maybe that's where it kind of sounds like narcissism, but it's not.
Yeah. Psychiatrists also said that Rodney's IQ at the time was 135.
Wow.
Pretty smart.
Pretty smart.
Once Rodney was diagnosed, he was then medically discharged from his duties and then returned home to California. He was 21 at this point, and once home, he said that he began to feel more self-assured, and he felt like his mental health was regulating. And he even opted to further his education, by enrolling at the University of California of Los Angeles, or UCLA.
Going back to the diagnosis, it does make, you said 21, that's right about the age as well, so that makes sense that he would be diagnosed at that point.
Right.
And so you said that he was required to be seen by psychiatrists, right? Like military psychiatrists?
Yeah, so I think when he had his mental break, I think it was when he was 20, 1943. Yeah, yeah, he was 20, 21.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Looking for a new perfume or cologne to match your style? Scentbird has got you covered. With over 600 scents to fall in love with, Scentbird is a fragrance subscription box that will give you plenty of choices. Just choose what you would like from their best sellers, activate your subscription, and receive your first 120 spray bottle. Click the link in the show notes now to receive an exclusive offer with Scentbird.
On September 2nd, 1964, 8-year-old Tali Shapiro was walking to school when a man in a vehicle came up beside her. He offered the young girl to give her a ride to school, but Tali refused. The man then told Tali that he knew her parents and that they needed her to be home. Reluctantly, Tali would climb into the man's vehicle. The two would then drive off, but not after a witness driving behind the suspected abduction vehicle overheard and saw the entire conversation.
Wow.
Feeling that something was off about the situation, the witness decided to follow the vehicle, where it eventually came to a rest at a residence. When questioned by Tali about where they were going, the man said that he had to quickly stop at his place to show the girl some pictures he took.
Okay, what?
Yeah.
That's like, not even a good excuse.
Yeah, he essentially, well, I think it's more because she's already in the vehicle, and he's not going to drive her to school now, yeah. So he's going to drive her to his place.
Gross.
With the, yeah, so. The man would then coax Tali into his residence, shutting the door behind them. The witness who had followed the vehicle found a phone and called police, giving a description of what they saw, what the child looked like, the description of the suspected abductor, and the address of where they might be found.
Wow.
Like, he was, like,
good on you. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I'm not gonna, yeah. And just in case. Rather yeah. safe than sorry.
I wonder why he didn't go up to the house, though. Maybe he's like, I'm overreacting, but I'm just gonna call just in case.
Yeah, like, the police will check it out, and if it's, like, not weird, then yeah. they'll know.
I'd rather call and be wrong than not call
yeah.
and be right.
Officer Chris Camacho responded to the scene. When Officer Camacho knocked on the door to the residence, Camacho heard rustling behind the door. Within a few seconds, a man opened the door, clearly shirtless, perhaps even nude, sweaty and sheltering himself behind the back of the door.
Ew.
Suspicious at this point, Camacho asked the man to step outside. The man then stated that he was in fact nude and that he had just gotten out of the shower.
I'm a little sweaty.
I just got out of the shower, that's why I'm so sweaty. I mean, I have water on me. This answer did not appease Camacho, who then commanded the man to open the door within 10 seconds, lest he kick the door in himself.
Hit him right in the dick when he kicks it open, that's what I was imagining.
Bull! With this, the man bolted further into the residence, leaving the officer with the front door cracked open. He was just like, oh, fuck this.
Well, that's silly because the officer can just come on in now.
Right. Like, the officer drew his service weapon and then forced the door open. What he saw is an image that the officer will never forget.
Oh, no.
There, lying on the kitchen floor, was a small, bloodied, lifeless body. 8-year-old Tali lay there with a large metal bar across her neck, placed there in order to keep her from escaping the assault. She had been stripped of her clothing, sexually assaulted, and beaten violently.
What?
Camacho later recalled thinking that there's no possible way that all of this blood was just from this little girl, saying, quote, "They say a picture is worth a thousand words, and that image of those little white Mary Jane shoes on the floor, with that metal bar that he used to strangle her, that puddle of blood, it just looks like too much blood to come out of a tiny 8-year-old like that," end quote.
Oh, that's horrible.
Heaps. As shocking as this was, Officer Camacho had to pull himself together in order to catch the perpetrator of this horrific crime. Camacho called for backup and emergency services and began to clear the house. However, room by room, Camacho came up empty-handed. The assailant had evaded Camacho through a window. Returning to the kitchen to investigate the scene further, Camacho found a light in all of the darkness that surrounded him in that room. The little girl had begun to gag and was thankfully breathing.
Oh my God.
Camacho began to treat the girl until emergency services arrived. Talia was taken to the hospital where she would be in a 32-day coma, needing months of hospitalization, but she would ultimately survive.
Oh my gosh, how incredible.
8 years old.
What a strong girl.
As police and investigators look around the scene for clues to the identity of the rapist and would-be murderer, they were disturbed to find hundreds of photos of young girls ranging from college age to toddlers.
Oh my god.
Seemingly, these individuals had no idea that their photos were being taken at most cases. In others, it appeared that the girls were willing participants at parties or beaches. Some photos were of women topless, some consensual, but others appeared to be more covert, like they were taken without the subject's knowledge.
Yeah. And I mean, let's be real, if you're at a party or the beach and you tell some girls to get together and smile, they're probably going to.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's innocent, or yeah, it seems innocent.
Among these photos and a few collections of fingerprints around the home, one thing did lead to the identity of the suspect, without a doubt, Rodney Alcala's UCLA ID.
Oh my gosh. Silly man.
Silly man.
So did he run away naked?
I don't know.
That's my question. He escaped out the window, like, nude and just bolted? Yeah.
And nobody, I mean, it's LA. I don't know.
Oh, sure.
Sorry, LA. Meanwhile, a one John Berger applied and was accepted to NYU in New York City. He was pursuing a degree in arts, majoring in photography. While pursuing his degree, he also obtained a job as an arts counselor at a children's camp in New Hampshire teaching photography.
What's this man's name?
John Berger.
Sounds fake.
He lived in Manhattan and seemed to do well for himself. John also worked for Blue Cross Blue Shield Association around the same time as infamous serial killer Richard Cottingham, also known as the Times Square Ripper.
Ooh.
Richard would go on to be suspected of killing over 18 people, possibly more, between the years of 1967 and 1980, although there is no real proof that John knew of Richard's double life. Mm. One day on June 24th, 1971, John was walking near his home when he came across 23-year-old Cornelia Crilly. Cornelia had, earlier in the year, been hired for her dream job. She was a TWA flight attendant. That sounds like so much fun when you're 23. Just be a flight attendant. Oh my gosh.
I have a girlfriend that is a flight attendant. She just got through training a few months ago, and she's in her mid-20s, and she just loves it. I'm like, jelly. I can't do it, though. There's no way. I can't even fly on a plane once, let alone, like, four times in a day.
For vacation. But yeah, four times a day. But I feel like you would just get desensitized to it.
Yeah. She'll come up, and she's like, yeah, I was in Chicago today, and then Miami, and then, you know, all these different cool places. That's That's crazy. All on the same day, right? You're just in, like, four different states.
Wild. She was so excited for this new venture, and with this new direction in her life, why not also add a new apartment? Cornelia was moving into the neighborhood with her roommate and fellow stewardess when she encountered John, who struck up a conversation with his new neighbor. John offered to help Cornelia upstairs with a few boxes, to which Cornelia agreed. Later that evening, Leon Borstein, which is Cornelia's boyfriend, had come to the residence, the new residence, only to realize that the door was locked. Leon knocked and knocked, but no response. Leon thought that this was strange, as Cornelia was expecting him home after work at the new apartment, but no bother. Leon and Cornelia were actually sharing a place around the corner from her new place. So originally, this is their old apartment.
Okay.
And she was moving out of this apartment with her girlfriend.
And there was still, like, a lapse in the lease or something.
Yeah, or I think maybe he wanted to maintain that apartment.
Oh, he stayed.
Yeah. So Leon thought maybe she just wanted to stay at the old place tonight for some reason. So Leon headed to the old apartment, but Cornelia was nowhere to be found. He began to call her new residence repeatedly with no answer. Leon found this to be very unusual, so he did phone the police. When police arrived, they had the landlord open the door. Inside, the police found the body of 23-year-old Cornelia.
Oh, shit.
She had been raped and strangled with her own nylon stockings. The violence Cornelia had endured was apparent. She had been beaten and bitten repeatedly. Besides finding Cornelia, the police found seemingly no other relative evidence as to who might have committed this crime. Although there was DNA at the scene, there was no other direct forensic evidence that was collected, and there were no eyewitnesses that came forward seeing the two together. Or whoever might have done this,
rather. Yeah, she just moved in there. That's so horrible.
And nobody in the neighborhood knows you.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what?
Like, they probably couldn't even point you out of a picture if they, you know, tried to.
At least not in the building, because Leon and her shared another apartment that was close by, but at least people in your building don't know you.
Well, not yet, yeah.
And even the perpetrator, right? The perpetrator, they're like, oh, okay, well, clearly this couple is moving in, right?
Mm-hmm.
If it's a man. I mean, we know who it is. It's the title of the episode. Cornelia's case would eventually go cold and would not be solved for 40 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Could you imagine?
No, I could not. That is horrible.
In Los Angeles, police were still on the lookout for Rodney Alcala. Eventually, he would catch the attention of the FBI, as it was likely that Rodney fled the state. He was added to the FBI's most wanted list, and within a month or two, the FBI would receive a phone call. Two girls from an art camp in New Hampshire recognized the photo of Rodney Alcala, and that it had a strong resemblance to their counselor, John Berger.
Interesting. Who saw that one coming?
Not me. This information was passed on to the camp director, who then contacted the FBI. Investigators confronted John at the camp, where he was taken into custody. So they essentially were holding him until they can confirm that the fingerprints that he gave a sample of matched the fingerprints at the Talia's Shapiro assault scene. So essentially they were confirming that John Berger's identity was that of Rodney Alcala. He was brought back to California to face the music. However, the Shapiro family, in an effort to put the trauma behind them and Tali, had actually moved the entire family to Mexico to start a new life.
Isn't that interesting? That, like, full circle?
Right?
Wow.
I mean, this is, like, right around the, California border. I'm not entirely sure where they were in Mexico, but... yeah.
I mean, I don't blame them, but it is frustrating to see him not get brought to justice. But I don't blame them. I don't know what I would do in that situation.
Right.
Especially if she survived. I mean, she is traumatized.
Right.
That must be extremely difficult for then and now, maybe 9-year-old to go through all that trial again and have all those wounds reopened.
Exactly. The Shapiro family had no intention of re-traumatizing Tali by picking her life back up in order to relive this assault. Rodney's charges would be dropped from a rape and attempted murder charge to a child molestation charge.
Ew.
He was sentenced to a measly 3 years in prison. However,
the next day.
No. He was released after serving just 17 months.
Wow. That's fucking great. Let him out. Let him go hurt someone else.
This is partly due to another evaluation that Rodney had, in which it was determined that incarceration allowed Rodney to regulate his routine, becoming a model inmate.
Because he has routine.
Right.
Once he's out, he will no longer have that routine because it's not required of him.
They're like, oh, well, because he's institutionalized, it's working for him, so, like, let's not do that anymore.
Yeah, what the heck?
Like, why? When Rodney did get out, he had to register as a sex offender. That was part of the deal, which, duh. This did not stop Rodney from becoming a freelance photographer, as he would be his own boss. Essentially, he didn't have to report to anybody.
Right.
He's like, oh, I'm making my money as a freelance photographer. I am my boss, so my boss knows that I'm a sex offender. Thanks.
My boss knows. It's me. I'm my boss.
I'm my boss. He just puts on a mustache and glasses and turns around.
I like to speak to the manager and turns around.
I'm the manager. Within 2 months of his release, Rodney was driving when he saw a 13-year-old, known only as Julie, walking down the street headed to school. Rodney pulled over and asked the girl if she needed a ride. Seems like his MO at this point. Julie then got in the vehicle, and instead of driving Julie to school, Rodney then asked the girl if she wanted to go to the beach.
Take some pictures.
Hey, instead of going to school, let's go to the beach. I'm a fun guy.
I know your parents.
Knowing it was wrong, but was feeling a little rebellious, Julie agreed. The two parked in the parking lot, and Rodney began to smoke some weed. He then urged the young girl to participate in sharing the weed with him, to which Julie agreed. Luckily, the smell of the marijuana alerted a police officer who was patrolling the beach parking lot.
Wow.
The officer approached the vehicle and after a short investigation realized that the two did not know each other. And in fact, Rodney was a convicted child molester.
Oh, weird.
Praise this man.
You're with a child.
You're with a child.
Like, God, what a creep.
Obviously, this broke Rodney's parole conditions and he was brought back to prison. This time, he would spend 2 years in prison. Still a slap on the wrist for Rodney. During his time in prison, once again, Rodney was a model prisoner. He participated in various groups and programs and was released in 1977. In New York, front page news. A young woman by the name of Ellen Jane Hover, aged 23, went missing after July 15, 1977. Ellen was somewhat famous locally, as she was the goddaughter of Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr.
Oh, wow.
As well as her father being a local nightclub owner. This is like, okay, really? Like, you're gonna fuck with this lady?
Yeah.
Ellen's body was not found until a year later. She was located under rocks by the Hudson River shore. Only one lead was found in the case. And it was the last written entry in Ellen's pocketbook, a meeting with a man by the name of John Berger.
He used the same name. That's silly.
Connections to Alcala would not be made until years later. Rodney, however, during this time when she wasn't found, which was essentially over the course of a year, Rodney had actually taken several pictures of women at the location of Ellen's body prior to her being discovered.
My God.
Like, later interviews with some women, because he claimed he was this big photographer, blah, blah, blah. He had taken women out there to take pictures of them standing on the rocks.
Unknowingly.
Unknowingly that there was one of his murder victims underneath these rocks
that they were standing on. That is sick.
It's really fucking sick. Also, I've seen his pictures. He's a crap photographer.
Also, you suck at photography.
It was also determined later on that due to Rodney's well-behaved demeanor in prison, Rodney's parole officer had actually allowed Rodney to take this trip to New York during this time. Because this is in New York.
Yeah.
And you're thinking like, oh, he was just released in 1977 for not only, you know, child molestation, when he really almost killed someone.
Attempted murder.
Attempted murder and sexually assaulted this 8-year-old. Then he's caught in a vehicle with a 13-year-old. He goes to serve 2 years. And you're thinking like, how would he possibly be in New York as John Berger with this girl? Because his parolee was like, just go. Yeah, his parole officer was just like, go. Oh, you need to go visit family? That's okay.
That's you're a
model
wild.
Model prisoner. Mm-hmm. That man should be held liable.
Yeah.
Rodney continues to scheme and manipulate his identity, landing a job with the New York Times. Mm-mm. He continued to do photography, claiming to be a critically acclaimed photographer, having no shortage of models and women to work with.
So he just stayed in New York and his parole officer was just cool with it?
Well, yeah, part of it is like, okay, well, now I'm here working. I'm hired by the New York Times.
Whatever.
So, and the thing is that the New York Times believed whatever crap he sold them, and they didn't even do a background check on this guy. He often bragged to others at work and at bars, carrying around photographs of the women, girls, and even young boys he had photographed.
I'd be like, please don't show me that. I don't want to see that. And why do you have that? I'm calling the authorities.
Right. Like, only on occasion when he felt like he could get away with it did he show young girls and young boys nude to others, claiming that they were photographed with the parents' permission and it was all in the name of art.
Okay, parents' permission... What, whoever, no, my ass, like, that's still illegal.
It is.
And not only is it illegal for you to take those photos, it's extra illegal for you to have them in your possession. Like,
you know, I kind of think, like, back to the whole era of, like, Roman Polanski and, like, Roman Polanski. So that's Sharon Tate's husband, right? The one that was murdered by Charles Manson family. So Charles Manson killed Sharon Tate. Sharon Tate was pregnant with Roman Polanski's baby. Okay. And I really feel like that mentally really messed him up in a way that is... Like, you can't come back from it. And this is not an excuse, just thinking about the mental health aspect of this. But he had sexually assaulted young girls in a jacuzzi at his house. The specific instance I'm talking about, because I feel like it happened more than once, in my opinion, the mother dropped her off. She was like 12, 13 years old, and the mother dropped her off because she's thinking, oh, this guy is a famous actor, director, whatever, and this is her casting? And that's, you know, things like that were just kind
of... She's going to go far with him.
Yeah. I mean, Drew Barrymore was dropped off at Studio 54 when she was...
Six,
you know? Is it 54?
I don't know.
You know, and there's cocaine and shit, you know? Like, yeah. I mean, it's just, it's not... adults were adults. You just trusted adults.
Yeah. And there, I mean, unfortunately, there are parents out there that are okay with exploiting their children.
Yeah.
Whether it's for fame or money or whatever. Yeah.
I don't think that's the case in this case.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's the case here. But it's not far-fetched when people that are of this New York status, you know, this guy works for the New York... I work for the New York Times. No, I know what art is. This is art.
That's true. If they would see it, and it wouldn't immediately raise red flags to some people.
Either way, these images were never reported to police. Bullshit. They should have been.
Yeah.
A lot of these child porn victims have never been identified to this day. In fact, there is a collection of images of people who have yet to be identified in Rodney Alcala's collection.
Wow.
These collections are available to the public online, each still needing to be located and identified to ensure that these individuals are actually alive and survive their encounter with Alcala.
Mm-hmm.
In November 1977, the body of Jill Barkham was found off of Mulholland Drive. She was found beaten, sexually assaulted, and strangled with her own blue jeans.
Ugh.
She had also been bitten several times. She was just 18 years old. During this time, however, two other perpetrators were actually arrested for similar crimes in the area. And although neither of these two criminals confessed to the killing, it was assumed by LAPD that either of them might be responsible for Jill's death, and therefore there was no other suspects interviewed for this.
Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah. Love when they get, like, a tunnel vision, right?
Or they get, they get a free pass, like the perpetrator. Like, oh, someone just took the blame for me. Cool.
I don't have to worry about it. I mean, clearly these people aren't trustworthy enough to be like, oh, I'm going to... Actually, you know what? They didn't do that. That was me.
Yeah, exactly.
In mid-December 1977, it was realized that Rodney Alcala was, in fact, John Berger. However, officially, in the case of Helen Hover, there was no evidence that Alcala was complicit in Ellen's disappearance. Just 2 days after receiving the news that investigators were not officially charging Rodney for the murder, 27-year-old Georgia Wexted was late picking up a coworker for work. So he's like, oh, I'm in the clear now.
Yeah, I will kill again.
After several hours, coworkers called for a welfare check on the woman's apartment. When police arrived, they noticed that the front door had been seemingly kicked in. Georgia was laying in her bedroom, deceased. She had been sexually assaulted, beaten, bitten, and strangled with her own stockings.
Oh my god, this guy's heinous.
Her genitals had also been mutilated.
Oh my god.
Rodney was not immediately linked to Georgia's murder. However, fingerprints and DNA were collected at the scene. In March 1978... police would come knocking on Rodney's door to ask about a particular set of murders. However, these would not be his own. They were that of the Hillside Strangler.
Oh, no.
A.K.A. the two perpetrators I mentioned earlier.
Yes.
A.K.A. Kenneth Bianchi and Angelino Bueno. They would be responsible for over 10 people's deaths in the area. And given Rodney's history, he was initially looked at as a suspect for these crimes.
I've been meaning to cover their case.
It's wild. But police would ultimately find that Rodney had alibis for the nights in question. By June 1978, an at-first unidentified woman was found strangled to death in an apartment complex laundry room. Her identity would not be discovered until months later, as 31-year-old legal secretary Charlotte Lee Lamb. DNA was also collected from her body at this scene for later comparison.
It's so frustrating that they have DNA, but they just don't have the
technology
to trace it.
Just days after Charlotte's body was identified, Rodney Alcala appeared on television, but it was not on the news as some might suspect.
What?
Rodney had been casted to participate in a show called The Dating Game. Now, we may have seen this show played out in other variations on shows or movies. For instance, MTV tried revamping it in the 2000s, RuPaul's Drag Race had a spoof where the queens dressed up as various celebrities. And in the movie Mallrats, the dating game is used as a ploy to get two crazy kids back together again. For those who might not know, the show is built in a way that a potential bachelorette asks various questions to three potential suitors, but they are hidden behind a screen, so looks mean nothing to the bachelorette. Based upon the way that the potential suitors answer their questions, the bachelorette determines which bachelor she would like to go on a date with. Expenses are paid for by the show, including the impending date. Rodney was described as a successful photographer who loved adventure and would someday go skydiving or maybe even purchase a motorcycle.
Oh, and he's also a registered sex offender. Pepper that in there.
And again, they didn't do their research.
I was going to say, shouldn't they have done a background check?
I don't even, you know what? I might actually, you can find the episode on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he went by Rodney. He might have gone by a different name.
A different alias.
Maybe John. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Rodney would actually win the show's episode.
Ew.
Getting the chance to take Cheryl Bradshaw out for their first date. The screen drops at the end, and Rodney and Cheryl see each other face-to-face for the first time. The two would then go backstage and begin to chat. According to an article by Marco Margaritoff, Cheryl said about this time, quote, "I started to feel ill. He was acting really creepy," end quote. The article goes on, quote, "While Cheryl Bradshaw initially agreed to meet her bachelor for a date, the following day, her instincts took over, and she called one of the show's producers, Ellen Metzger," end quote. She went on to say, quote, "Ellen, I can't go out with this guy," end quote, recalled Metzger. Quote, "There's weird vibes that are coming off of him. He's very strange. I'm not comfortable. Is that going to be a problem?" And of course, Ellen said no. Cheryl would not go on her date with Rodney. And in the following year, in February 1979, Rodney picked up 15-year-old hitchhiker Monique Hoyt. Monique was traveling alone, and Rodney found the opportunity to pick her up. Monique got in the car willingly, and the two traveled up to the mountains. Rodney coaxed the girl out of the car once they arrived to their destination and began to ask her to undress. She did, and Rodney began to take pictures of her. He then began to touch her, and although Monique did not like what was going on, she realized that she was out at Alcala's mercy, that she felt like she had no choice. She's out in the middle of nowhere with this dude.
Yeah.
Rodney continued to sexually assault Monique and then began to rape her. Rodney continued to take pictures of his assault on Monique.
Gross.
He then, seemingly out of nowhere, became enraged and began hitting Monique, bludgeoning her over the head repeatedly with a rock.
What the fuck?
Alcala choked the girl violently and then sodomized her. Miraculously, Monique never lost consciousness during this. And due to her being submissive to Rodney's attack, he chose to clothe the girl and place her back in the car. Rodney pulled into a gas station, and when he walked inside to pay for gas and use the restroom, Monique realized her opportunity. She would escape, and Monique was then helped by others, who then called police.
Oh, wow.
Rodney Alcala was arrested and charged with assault and rape. However, his mother bailed him out of jail.
Oh, great.
That's what he needs, is to not be incarcerated. We've seen it.
That's crazy. Like, I don't know. I don't even know what to say.
After his arrest and while Rodney was awaiting his trial, essentially, there was no hiding his record from the New York Times at this point. Like, he's like, they're going to find out about it, so... Essentially, he resigned.
He's like, I missed a week of work because I was in jail.
I was in
but
jail.
Don't fire me.
Yeah. Don't look into my background. You're probably already aware that craft beers have exploded in popularity over the past decade. But what you might not know is that there are thousands of awesome craft beers being produced by these new microbreweries every day. With Craft Beer Club, each order will showcase two breweries from different regions in the U.S., and includes four beer styles with a brand new box with each shipment. You will also receive publications that detail the history about the featured breweries, tasting notes, pairing options, and maybe even a little trivia. Click on our link in the show notes and receive an exclusive offer today with Craft Beer Club. In June 1979, 22-year-old Jill Parento left her job as a computer operator early in order to attend a baseball game. This was her last known whereabouts. The next morning, when Jill did not return to work, police were called to her residence for a welfare check. The door had signs of forced entry, and there in the apartment, Jill was found dead. Which is interesting to me, because he has two types of MOs here. It's picking up the young girls on their way to school, or it's breaking into people's apartments.
Yeah.
I wonder if he's stalking them before he's doing this, and then when he tries to follow them into the apartment, maybe they struggle and that's the force.
Maybe. And he obviously knows that, like, these young girls live at home with their parents, so it's easier to abduct them while they're by themselves on the side of the road.
That's true.
And these older women, not older, but you know what I mean, like, they're young adults are probably alone, yeah, by themselves, and he knows that.
Jill had been raped, strangled, beaten, and bitten. DNA was collected from the scene.
Take a freaking mold of the bite mark, please.
Right?
Like, god dang it.
I don't think odontology was really all this big then, though.
Well, should have been.
Should have been.
Go back in time.
If I could go back in time. That was originally what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
There's a reason that there's a bunch of old people in that field. It's because you have to take forensics and dentistry.
Yeah,
for sure. It's a lot. You have to have a doctorate. It's crazy. Robin Christine Samso was 12 years old when she was riding her bike home after attending her ballet class on June 20th, 1979. She stopped by the beach to visit with some friends. A witness known as Dana, who was 20 years old at the time and a firefighter, noticed a creepy-looking, dark, curly-haired man on the side of the road on her way to work. It appeared as if he was struggling with a young blonde girl on the edge of some woods. Although this seemed unusual at the time, Dana likely thought that this must be two family members having a fight, or maybe it's a dad having an exhausting time controlling his daughter.
Don't assume that.
Dana essentially talked herself out of communicating with police about what she saw.
Again, we'd rather you overreact than underreact and something bad happens.
Robin would not be found for another 12 days. Her body dumped in the foothills of LA, and she was missing an earring.
I'm also not blaming this witness. I'm just saying out loud, just for the future.
Well, I also read in a few other instances that she went and investigated the woods herself and then may or may not have seen something and then still chose not to report it and then went back a third time with someone else because she thought what she found was animal bones.
Oh.
And it turned out to be the remains of this little girl.
I don't know. Like, it's so hard because fear is so powerful. Like, it could just be, like, maybe if I tell someone else, then they'll call. Like, I'm so scared. I don't want to get hurt by this person. Maybe they saw me or whatever. You know?
And I think some people are afraid of the reaction of a parent. Like, if it's really this child's parent and the parent's like, mind your own business. Yeah. Like, what are you looking at, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, and I don't know. Is it better to have that potentially 5-minute interaction with a very angry stranger? Or, but again, if this person is capable of hurting someone, you don't know
if they're gonna hurt you too.
But she should have reported it.
It's hard, yeah.
In my opinion. When asked about the day that Robin went missing, some of her girlfriends said that a creepy man with curly hair approached the young girls and asked them to take photographs with him.
Imagine being described as creepy by multiple different people.
Imagine being described as having halitosis.
Yeah.
Richard Ramirez. Robin was the only one who seemed to agree to take photos with the stranger, but once out of sight, her friends could not find her.
Oh, no.
Like, they're like, okay, sure, but like, stay within eyesight, and then she's gone.
That's so scary.
A composite drawing was created by the descriptions of the girls, and once the sketch began to circulate around the police station, Rodney Alcala's own parole officer recognized him from the sketch as potentially being Rodney.
He's like, yeah, that's my AWOL.
That's my parolee
that I don't keep track of.
God. The sketch was featured on the nightly news. And once Rodney saw this, he decided to chemically straighten his hair. But when the chemicals wore off, Rodney decided to cut his own hair off.
Like, there's like a creepy curly-headed guy. He's like, god dang it, they keep making fun of my hair.
Yeah, I can get rid of my hair, but you can't get rid of that creepy. Rodney would also remove the carpet from his vehicle. But this did not stop police from eventually revealing that Rodney Alcala was, in fact, their prime suspect in at least Robin's murder.
And now he has wavy hair.
Now he's got bald head.
Oh, he shaved his head.
Rodney told others around him at this time, specifically his girlfriend, who we have not mentioned.
Oh.
That he planned on moving to Dallas for no specific reason.
Hmm.
He's like, career opportunities, y'all. Like, I'm just gonna...
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with the shaved head or my dyed blonde mustache or any... Me trying to put on weight so I don't look gangly and creepy.
I'm either gonna move to Dallas or I'm gonna flee the country. It's still up in the air.
One or the other. I have family in Mexico. Before leaving permanently, Rodney would rent a storage unit in Seattle, moving some items into the unit before traveling down to Texas. Although he told no one of this unit at the time.
Rent a storage unit, tell no one.
Tell no one. Hot on his trail, detectives show up to Alcala's residence, which he shared with his girlfriend. They had found a receipt for the storage unit in Seattle.
Mm.
They travel to Seattle and open Rodney's storage unit. And there among his belongings was an earring that matched the one left behind at Robin's scene.
Wow.
He was like taking tokens. And I don't know how many tokens he took.
Yeah.
I really don't. I don't know if that was put in the trial. Didn't really see anything about tokens.
He probably did.
He probably did. Also included in the unit was over 1,700 photographs of mostly explicit situations.
Oh my God.
I think only 100 have actually been released to the public for identification. Because the others are just too graphic.
Right. And, like, even if it's just their face, it's probably still graphic.
Yeah.
But, like, that's in Seattle. Like, why so far away? Like, why wouldn't you rent... I mean, when people take photographs like that, in my personal opinion, and they have trophies, they go back to them frequently. They like to have those mementos to go refer back to.
Mm-hmm.
So, interesting to me that he would have them so far away from him.
I think what he was thinking is, okay, I live in L.A., I get a storage unit up in Seattle. No one will find it because I'm telling everyone, anybody that's close to me, that I'm going to Texas.
Yeah.
So it's a complete opposite way. It's true. At least it's safe. I mean, he's still paying for the storage unit.
That's true.
It's not like he took it with him. And if he was going to get caught between LA and Texas, he wasn't going to drive with them, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Rodney would eventually be found and arrested on multiple charges, including lewd acts with a child, kidnapping, and murder. Rodney was held without bail, and Rodney would ultimately plead not guilty. He first went on trial for Robin's murder, in which he would be found guilty and sentenced to death. Although this verdict would be appealed and overturned, given that the jury was told about Rodney's prior crimes, and therefore painted an unflattering picture of the defendant.
No one did that to him. He did that to himself.
Yeah. That's your past, bro.
You painted an unflattering Bob Ross painting of your life, okay? No one else.
They're happy little accidents.
Oh, jeez.
That's awful. A second trial was granted in 1986, and even without the jury's hearing any priors, they still convicted him of first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to death
again.
In 2001, Alcala again filed for habeas corpus, and challenged that he had not had a fair trial due to witness tampering. He said something about somebody being hypnotized, and that's why.
That checks out.
Either way, it was granted, and again, was overturned.
What?
This decision was upheld again in 2003. So they're just like, yeah, clearly so-and-so was hypnotized. You get a new trial. In preparation for another trial, DNA was then processed with new technology and linked Alcala to the murders of Jill Barcombe, Georgia Wexted, Charlotte Lamb, and Jill Parento. So it's like, okay, continue to appeal over and over again.
Yeah, we now got you.
Now technology is developed. Now you really can't get out of this shit.
Yeah, exactly.
Dummy.
The evidence was misplaced.
Rodney decided to represent himself, as one would.
He's like, that wasn't me, that was John.
Patricia.
That was probably his biggest argument.
His defense this time was simply that he didn't remember committing any of these crimes.
Of course not.
As a part of Rodney's closing argument, he insisted that the nearly 20-minute song Alice's Restaurant by Arlo Guthrie be played, and it is somehow related, and I really don't care to read or research his explanation of how, because I have no idea. Something about the protagonist talking about killing someone. I didn't care to Google it because I don't, if you want to Google it, just Google it.
No, I won't. But since when do murder defendants who decide to defend themselves get requests?
I don't know. Yeah.
I don't,
he's like,
yeah.
All right, up next on the DJ stage,
yeah,
it's like, Arlo Guthrie's Alex's Restaurant yeah. for the next 20 minutes.
Yeah, like, what the hell?
Oh my gosh.
What a random request.
Yeah, absolutely.
What an odd thing to say.
I think it's just, he simply just wanted to piss people off.
And that's the antisocial in him, the antisocial personality disorder. Yeah. I also think that that comes with, he must have narcissistic tendencies. Because to think, I mean, anybody that testifies for themselves, it has narcissistic tendencies. I'm just saying. He's like, I'm the greatest and I'm going to tell you why.
Yeah.
Can you play this 20-minute song and I'll talk over it for 20 minutes? But he thinks he's smarter than everybody.
Yeah.
It's the antisocial and the narcissism. He thinks he's going to outsmart everybody. No one can do this better than me. Like Ted Bundy, like I need to testify for myself
mm-hmm.
because no one else is going to get me free.
Nope. Yeah, exactly.
And when it doesn't happen, he's like, well, system's rigged. It's like, it's never his fault.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. It's very much, no one can explain my case the way that I can explain my case. It's like, well, a lawyer has many years of training to do that, you know?
They're definitely going
to
believe me. They think they can outsmart and outwit everybody.
I think that it's Ted Bundy's narcissistic tendency to want to become a lawyer because he makes himself feel smarter than everyone else to be a lawyer. So at least he has some history in that.
Yeah.
This man has never taken a law class.
That's true.
Ever.
But again, the antisocial, he has to outsmart, outwit, outplay. This ain't Survivor, bro. Come on. You're getting convicted.
Rodney Alcala would be found guilty of all 5 murder charges and, again, was sentenced to death. To avoid Alcala from filing yet again, the courts actually changed Alcala's status to, quote, convict awaiting execution, end quote.
I was going to say, that's got to be some kind of record. He's gotten sentenced to death like 5 different times.
Yeah, they were like, let's just switch his status to someone awaiting.
So it's pending.
Yeah, exactly. Execution, and he can't file appeals.
Loophole.
Right? Alcala would eventually be extradited to New York to face charges on the murders of Cornelia Criley and Ellen Hover. Although he initially pled not guilty, he would change his plea to guilty and accept the charges of murder for an additional 25 years, because at this point,
who cares? Yeah. I'm surprised he did that, though. I feel like he would be stubborn and be like, nope.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at this point, his fate is sealed
because
he will be executed.
But that's what I'm saying. That stubbornness, that I don't care about anybody kind of mentality, like, that's kind of interesting that he would say, like, agree to it. I feel like I wouldn't be surprised if he had said, nope, not doing that. Sorry.
Maybe he just didn't want to be in New York. He's like, I don't want to be in this prison.
That's true.
I don't know. Rodney James Alcala would die in prison in 2021 at the age of 77 to an unspecified illness.
COVID.
He's got the vid. This would actually be the same date as his arrest date to the year.
Wow. Yeah.
There are several other cases of rape and murder that Alcala has been suspected of committing. 68-year-old Morgan Rowan came forward after Alcala's death to say that she was raped by Alcala in 1968 when she was just 16 years old.
Oh my god.
Could you imagine that long?
Yeah.
To wait to tell your story.
And only feeling comfortable doing so when your perpetrator is dead.
When he's dead. And when you know he can't hurt you anymore.
Well, shit, I mean, seeing him get appeal after appeal for the death penalty, I would be scared too. I'd be like, he's gonna get out. And then if I publicly say this, he's gonna come for me and finish the job or whatever. Like, that's so scary.
Pamela Lamson was 19 years old when she disappeared after being approached by a photographer to take pictures. Her badly beaten body was discovered near a hiking trail in 1977. Rodney Alcala was actually charged with the murder of a 22-year-old named Christine Thornton from San Antonio, Texas. The murder took place in 1977 when Christine was hitchhiking to a ride in order to meet her boyfriend, as the two of them were planning on living together or moving in together. Pictures of Christine were found among Rodney Alcala's property. However, Rodney was ill later in his life and was unable to travel to Texas to stand trial for her murder.
Oh my gosh.
So he's been charged with her murder, but never tried for her murder.
Like, all of these situations and, like, those poor families.
Yeah.
Like, you're never going to get that legal justice.
I feel like I would need that. You and I have talked about this. Like, I feel like I would need that for somebody to tell me or it be proven or be filed in some way. There are still over 100 photos of individuals that have not been identified by the greater public. We will provide a link in the show notes if you or anyone else you know recognizes these individuals in these photos, and you are encouraged to report to the LAPD even if these individuals are alive and well, they right. still need to eliminate that these are not victims of Rodney Alcala.
Definitely.
Although Rodney Alcala has been convicted of only 5 murders, he is suspected of having over 130 rape or suspected murder victims.
Oh my gosh.
130. Given the amount of photos.
Right.
And potentially, and again, these very graphic photos haven't been released, but we have no idea what these photos contain.
Yeah.
If these people are in a position to where, you know, they likely didn't survive.
Right. And it's like the photos that they know of people that have been deceased, like in those photos, you can prove that those people died. You can't prove that all the other people are deceased, mm-hmm. but you can't prove that they're alive until yeah. people come forward and dispute it, you know?
Exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
That's Rodney Alcala.
Dang, what a case. I thought it was a completely different case. I told you, I think when we paused for a second, I told you I thought it was the guy that was on Family Feud and it was like, who's the first person you kill? And he's like, my wife. And then his wife like dies like a few months later. So I don't know. That wasn't the prompt, but
yeah,
something like that. But wow, that was a lot of dropping the ball on a lot of people's parts. Mm-hmm. Like the parole officer, the, you know, law enforcement for releasing him, the failure to do background checks for the New York Times and the dating game. Like mm-hmm. there was a lot of times where he was like pretty close to being found out and yeah. still got away with it. Yeah. And then of course, 4 times or something, he got appealed the death penalty. Like, that's insane.
Yeah. As speaking to that antisocial personality disorder, like you said, with the whole narcissistic tendencies, him even applying to be on a dating show when he's wanted by the yeah. FBI, like, are you, come on.
He's arrogant.
That's
for sure.
So arrogant. And then, yeah, there was also a little bit of speculation that with his narcissistic tendency, the reason he victimized the last few of his victims was after he was rejected by Cheryl Bradshaw, that she refused to go on that date, and how good a publicity that must have looked if they had worked out or they dated right. after that, and that he was so mad at her, he continued to victimize other women.
Well, she definitely dodged a bullet, and she trusted her instinct. I mean, yeah. she saved her own life with that instinct. Yeah. I fully believe that.
For sure.
Oh, that's horrible, though. Like, all the other victims that he had. Again, like, we'll put the photos, a link to the photos mm-hmm. down there. And if anybody knows anything or even thinks you know something, a speculation, just call. Like, it's, like I said, you'd rather call and be wrong than yeah. not call. And, yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that would be really helpful in this case to try to bring some of these cases to justice or just rule them out as being harmed.
Absolutely. And we have to remember that these photographs, police don't know where they were taken. We have to remember that he lived in New York, California, Texas. He at least went to Washington for the storage unit. Anywhere in between where he may have driven. He lived in North Carolina when he was in the military. I feel like everyone that's listening to this episode should challenge themselves. Take a look at the photos and see. I mean, worst case scenario, it's not the person you think it is.
Yeah.
Best case scenario, you can report that someone is alive and well.
Right.
And they weren't a victim of Rodney Alcala's.
You never know.
Or, like you said, be able to bring him to justice and have some closure for a family that really needs it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for bringing that case. It was a really good one. Mm-hmm. You want to tell the people what we're doing again for Patreon?
Yeah, we're actually going to be covering James Holmes. He was the perpetrator of the Aurora Theater shooting, the Dark Knight Theater shooting, and that happened in Denver, or Aurora, Colorado, which we were recently fortunate to visit. And I was able to actually go to the memorial, and pretty powerful stuff. And we will include photos of that memorial for that episode.
Absolutely. So if you'd like to get access to that episode and all of our other bonus content, go to patreon.com/diagnosingakiller. Takes just a few minutes to sign up, and that's going to be our tiers 3 and 4 members that will have access to that exclusive content.
Yeah. Thanks for your support, y'all.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you to our existing Patreon members, and we will see you guys next time.
Yep.
Love you.
Love you.
Bye.
Rifle Paper Company is known for their high-quality, handmade designs that are sure to brighten and lighten up every room in your home. Rifle Paper has been creating one-of-a-kind designs since 2009. From stationery to decor, find your favorite design and shop from there. My favorite design is Bramble. I can get this design in duvets, tumblers, an ottoman, and even wallpaper. Nathan and Anna Bond are a husband and wife team, and they are the brilliant minds behind Rifle Paper Company, which is fueled by local Florida printers. Click the link in the show notes to receive an exclusive offer today. Rifle Paper Company, quality products that bring beauty into the everyday.